Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. We are bringing classics to your door. We all love a bit of classics. So today we have Tim Whitmarsh with us, who is a classicist and a professor of Greek culture at the University of Cambridge. He's also a published author and has written books like Dirty Love, The Genealogy of the Ancient Greek Novel, and Local Knowledge and Micro-Identities in the Roman Greek World. You can also find him on the BBC and on the radio. Welcome, Tim.
Hello, hiya.
We are so excited to have you on. My best friend right now is secretly throwing daggers at me saying, I can't believe you've got him on. That's just the most amazing thing ever. So Linda, you're listening out there? Ha ha ha. So how is lockdown?
Lockdown is kind of weird, isn't it? It's so weird. My hair is almost down to my knees. Now the garden is just sort of ridiculously overgrown. Time has lost all meaning. I'm going mad. Thank you. Thanks for asking.
I think archaeologists are in the worst position right now because all of their digs have been cancelled. And what are they doing? They're sitting at home and not digging.
Yeah, well, they can come dig my garden.
There we go. Any archaeologists listening and you're bored, you can head up and dig Tim's garden for him. So, or you can come to Poland and do mine, you know, either way, or I think we'd both be quite happy. So we're going to talk about Greeks today, Greek history. So let's first of all start with who were the Greeks? Who were they?
Well, if you ask, I remember Michael Gove talking about this and saying that people these days don't know which came first, the Greeks or the Romans or the Egyptians or whatever. And people often think of the ancient Greeks in those terms. They think of them as occupying a particular time slot before the Romans, after the Egyptians, that sort of thing. And of course, the truth of it is completely different. The Greek peninsula has been inhabited since the 4th millennium BCE, probably before that. But, you know, the big migrations happened in the 4th millennium BCE. Then, you know, it's continuously inhabited, obviously, right up till the present day. So the Greeks are, you know, a huge number of people over a huge span of time. When we talk about the ancient Greeks, typically we mean Greeks from about 800 BC through to about 500 AD. These limits are, in a sense, arbitrary. You know, it's not as if they stop being ancient on, you know, January the 1st, 501 AD. But, you know, they're sort of useful ways of organising thought, really. So the first, the reason we begin in the 8th century BCE is for a number of reasons. One of them is Homer, basically. That's our earliest text of Greek literature, dates from around that sort of time. But we also get the phenomenon of the city-state emerging at that sort of time, when we get places like Athens, Sparta, Corinth emerging with a particular type of social makeup that is built around the idea of citizenship and inclusivity. And then they don't all become democracies, but democracy as we understand it is very much a sort of outgrowth of that sort of city-state mentality. So, as I say, the Greeks, as we understand them now, the ancient Greeks, are really, I suppose, defined by politics and by culture, the legacy of Homer, but also the legacy of artworks and, you know, statues and vase paintings, that sort of thing. Very distinctive visual styles that that carried a strong sense of Greek identity. I should say, actually, just one thing about the word Greek, which is really a Latin word. The Greeks did use the word Greek, but very minimally. The Greeks themselves, modern Greeks, but also in antiquity, called themselves a different word, which is Hellene.
Ah, that's quite interesting, because I have a question that I think I'm going to start asking every single classicist, or more classicists that deal with Greek history. Is the word Panhellenism, it's been a debate between classicists everywhere. Were the Greeks, were they Panhellenic? Well, first of all, what is Panhellenism, and were they Panhellenic? Because people suggest places like Delphi were Panhellenic.
Okay, so the word itself is composed of two elements, Pan and Hellenic. the Hellenic bit, I've just explained, that means Greek. Pan means all. So we use the word Panhellenic to mean places or sites or categories of thinking that cut across the city-state structure. So if you go to Athens and you ask, you know, what is your identity to somebody you meet, they would say an Athenian, probably. And if you go to Sparta, they'd say, I'm a Spartan. But in a way, clearly, they participate in a wider Hellenism and a wider concept of Greekness. This isn't a passport-carrying culture. You know, there are no absolute boundaries of the Greek and the non-Greek and so forth. There are no firm ways of defining who is and who isn't Greek. But there is a loose sense of affiliation between all these different Greek city-states. And I should say, actually, there are many Greek city-states beyond the Greek peninsula as well in antiquity, in what's now Turkey, along the shores of the Black Sea, North Africa. They sent out lots of colonies as well, to southern Italy as well. So there are Greeks all over the place. And what unites them is, as I mentioned before, partly culture and politics, very distinctive ways of living one's life, but partly also other phenomena like religion, language, and a sense of shared descent. And these can come differently into play at different times. Some people sometimes say shared descent, you know, we all descend from the same person, an original person called Helene, who gives the name Hellenes. Of course, it's entirely made up, this genealogy. But that's one way of articulating pan-Hellenism, of the collective Greek identity. We all descended from the same person. But there are many others, and people will put the accent on different sorts of things. Some people will say it's all about education. It's all about, you know, what you're brought up reading and understanding and so forth. And as you say, there are sites like Delphi and the Olympic Games, which were held in the northern Peloponnese. These are sites which are open to all Greeks. So they have a significance that is more than local. They're not just tied to that city-state. They're actually have a wider significance. So there's a guy called Alexander of Macedon, who you may have heard of, but it's not that Alexander. It's not Alexander the Great. It's one of his ancestors, Alexander the First of Macedon, actually, who pitched up at the Olympic Games. And because he's from Macedon, which is right at the north of the Greek peninsula, there's a question over whether he's properly Greek or not. And they have these people called the Hellanodikai, the judges of Hellenism, who actually sort of have to convene and work out whether he is Greek or not. And luckily for him, they say, yes, okay, you know, you've told a good story about your Hellenism, so you are Greek, so you can participate in these pan-Hellenic games.
Wow, I didn't realise there was a panel that would actually judge if you were Greek or not. That is incredible.
That's a very ancient Greek approach to things, actually. They were really into governance and, you know, sort of everything, you know, they often had these sort of legal, quasi-legal arrangements, and everything had to be sort of above board and visible and recorded and, you know, accountable and all that sort of thing. So yes, even when it comes to identity, I mean, that's a pretty extreme case. I think most, you know, it's a wacky story, and that's why I told it. But yeah, they did.
Are there any stories of people that were denied on the panel? Talking about Pan-Hellenism, did the Greeks think of themselves as a unified people?
Well, this goes back to the point about passports and passport carrying. There is no mechanism for deciding whether one is or is not Greek. There is for citizenship of a city-state. It's recorded, but it again goes back to the sort of governance thing. You know, the Greeks are obsessed. Greeks in each individual city-state have tallies and, you know, lists of people who are citizens, and you have to go through certain processes. You have to meet certain criteria to be a citizen. So that's all kind of cut and dried. And of course, you know, people go to court to try and argue that they are citizens when they're not treated. You know, but I mean, there are basically citizenship status within the city-state is pretty solidly defined. Hellenism, though, being Greek, is not at all solidly defined. So I mentioned the Macedonians, and they're a really good, interesting example because they really are on the border between, you know, the Greek world and the non-Greek world. The Greeks tend to think in particular that the further north you go into Europe, weirdly, given, you know, how obsessed we are with European identity now, but the Greeks didn't think, they thought that was pretty barbarous space up north. So the Macedonians hover between the Greek and the non-Greek world. And they can be seen as Greek or not Greek, depending on circumstances. So the more famous Alexander the Great, his dad, Philip II, when he was sort of campaigning around Greece, there were Athenians. There was one Athenian who said, let's back him. Let's, you know, he's a sort of, Philip is a fantastic Greek who we're going to back to go and beat the Persians. And then the Greeks will be triumphant in the world. And there was another Greek at exactly the same time saying, this is terrible barbarian. We need to resist him. We need to throw everything we can at him to try and stop him from taking over the Greek world. So the same person could be seen as Greek or non-Greek, depending on which side of the political fence you happen to sit at that particular time. So no, I mean, the Greeks, it's a hazy unity. It's a sort of, it's an asystematic approach to identity, very negotiable at the edges. And of course, the further away from the Greek peninsula you get, the more uncertain it is. In the Roman Empire, at the time of Hadrian, there was a thing called the Panhellenion, which was an institution which was actually designed to work out whether cities in far-flung places were actually Greek or not. And if they were, I mean, consequences flowed, like tax benefits and that sort of thing. But the way in which we've actually got applications to the Panhellenion, people sort of writing and saying, oh, can I be Greek, please? You know, and it's really interesting the way that they construct it. One of them, for example, just has a sort of a long mythological story about how Perseus, the legendary figure, dropped by in their particular area in central Turkey, and I can't remember exactly, so it impregnated a few local people. And that was the origins of the city-state. And that's why they should be seen as Greek. But this was a successful petition to the Emperor Hadrian to have the Greekness of these people acknowledged. I come back to the point that the reason why people want Greekness is because of prestige, and you know, particularly under the Romans really value Greekness. So it becomes a sort of form of identity that everyone wants in on.
Are there any examples of what would be required of you to be, for example, an Athenian citizen?
Yeah, well, Athenian citizenship is really interesting and really horrid, actually. In the middle of the 5th century, the period that everyone always thinks of as a kind of golden age of democracy and inclusivity and so forth, except for women, except for slaves and so forth. And in that era, about 451, Pericles, who's another person that everyone praises and lionizes the whole time, including Boris Johnson, Pericles passes this citizenship law, or persuades the Athenians to pass the citizenship law, which says that you have to have two Athenian parents to be a citizen. And when I say you, this is a male Athenian child, because only men have citizenship, blah, 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 blah. But you have to have two bona fide citizen parents in order to be an Athenian citizen, which is actually, it's like all of these things, you know, the more you think about it, the more kind of terrible it is, because it's built around a myth of racial purity. I use the word, it's slightly anachronistic word, racial there, but, and it's built around this mythology which comes up around that sort of time that starts claiming that the Athenians are born from the soil of Athens itself, that the first Athenian was actually born in Athens as part of the, you know, was born not of a mother, but born of the soil. So all Athenians, subsequent Athenians, the claim is, are genetically descended from this first primeval Athenian. And the Athenians use this to distinguish themselves from other peoples, other city-states, who don't have the same purity of bloodline, and therefore are more degenerate. So it is a archetypically racist way of constructing identity, built around differentiation from others, built around exclusion of immigrants, built around myths of blood purity. And it won't surprise anyone that this this belief system attracted the interest of the Nazis, and they were very taken by this Athenian way of constructing identity.
I was about to say that, because while you were speaking, saying that both parents had to be from Athenian bloodline, I'm thinking, wow, All I can think of is the Third Reich racial purity laws that are just going through my mind, that if you had a Jewish mother or a father, for example, or grandfather, or even further back, that's it. You're classified as Jewish. It's very interesting that it goes so far back in history.
And it has strong gender implications as well, actually, because alongside the sort of the exclusion of non-Athenians, the effect of this mythology are to devalue the role of women, because this is the famous French scholar called Nicole Laureau wrote an awful lot, very persuasive, very influential stuff about this. First of all, women aren't considered to be necessary for childbirth, because the first Athenian was born from the soil, not from a woman. So the role of women is downgraded. They're associated with matter rather than, if you like, the sort of the true essence of the human being. They just provide the soil, the substrate, rather than the actual identity of the person. But also it puts a lot of pressure on the idea of adultery. So we have all these dramas about people like Clytemnestra and, in a different sort of way, Medea, terrifying women who act with autonomy and agency, and in the case of Clytemnestra, commit adultery with another man. And this is a sort of, we always say these are amazing works of literature, which they are, of course, amazing works of literature, and they're very complex, and they're not reducible to ideology. But at one level, they're about scary women, and, you know, what happens if you don't control your women enough, and if you don't keep them in the household, if you don't protect them from adulterers, and so forth. So, as I say, there's a strong gender component to it as well.
I don't think I'd like to be a woman in Greek times. It sounds quite oppressive. So we've spoken about Greek people, how they view themselves, but what did they think of others?
I suppose all forms of identity are at some level differential forms of identity, aren't they? They're ways of saying we are this because we are not that. And it's often been pointed out that Greek, even the Greek language itself, is very binary in its structures. It has particles that oppose this to that. It has forms of syntax that divide sentences into two. The earliest forms of Greek verse, the hexameter verse in which the Homeric poems were composed, every single line of them falls naturally into two. So the Greeks did think in this sort of very binaristic way, and a lot of their early science and cosmology and medicine and so forth was built around oppositions between the hot and the cold, the dry and the wet, and so forth. So it was almost inevitable that Greek identity would come to be associated with this same binary mode of thinking. And particularly in the 5th century, Edith Hall has done a huge amount of work on this, very influential work, particularly in the 5th century, when the Persians have just been repelled. The Persians invade in the early 5th century twice, and they're repelled. And the Athenians assume leadership, de facto leadership, of much of the Greek world. And they say, we will provide the navy and the armies, and we'll coordinate the armies and so forth to repel any further Persian incursions. So they start building up this sort of network of alliances, which is called the Delian League. But very soon it becomes a sort of Athenian empire, sort of top-down Athenian sort of monetizing venture, which is basically what pays for the Parthenon, the most famous building in the whole of Greece, that was built as a treasury for the Delian League. And the Delian League's rhetoric is profoundly anti-Persian. And in this era, the word barbaros, which seems to originate as a sort of parody of unintelligible language, the word barbaros becomes almost exclusively applied to Persians. So Persians become the other in this period, and a sort of weaponized, leveraged other, in order to try and shore up this increasingly hierarchical Delian League thing with the Athenians at the top. So the Athenians are presenting themselves as the embodiment of Greekness, and they present in opposition to the Persians. But of course, over time, after the conquests of Alexander the Great in the 4th century BCE, when the Greek world expands hugely and goes into all sorts of other places, there are all sorts of other forms of otherness that emerge in really quite interesting ways. But it's not just those other forms of otherness. I'm using the word other too much here, but these other forms of otherness are sort of quite interesting and complex and tangled. And, so if you take Jews, for example, the Greeks sort of come into contact with Jews in the period after the conquest of Alexander the Great. And their reaction is sometimes a sort of horrified aghastness at how odd and, you know, how sort of weirdly monotheistic these people are in the dietary laws. And sometimes there is a form of, there is a real admiration there as well. So it's not a simple story. The Greeks are, you know, have, amongst other things, have endless curiosities about other sorts of people. And there is a sort of relativism that you find in the Greek world from very early on. The historian Herodotus often embodies this idea that, you know, you think you do, your customs are the best, but if you go to another place, you'll see that people do things in a completely different way. And in fact, actually, it's just about, you know, local perspective. From above, there is no culture that is better than any other culture. So you get all these sort of cross currents tensing against each other. There is this sort of sense of otherness and exclusion of barbarians and belief in Greek superiority. But as I say, that tenses against other currents, which are more universalistic and more cosmopolitan and more relativistic.
How do they view the Romans?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. That's a really good question. So the Greeks first come across, well, you know, Romans are mentioned quite early on in Greek literature, actually, almost from the start, or at least Italians are. But the Romans sort of come onto the Greek radar in a serious way in the 3rd century BCE. And the Romans, you know, proceed by sort of slow accretion of little bits of territory, often, you know, bequeathed to them or negotiated by treaty and so forth. The image of the Romans as just conquerors who, you know, went in taking over everything militarily is very simplistic. So as I say, that, you know, the Greeks in that era begin to become aware of the Roman world. And in particular, in the 2nd century, there's a lot of, actual military conquest of Greek territories in that sort of era. And you would expect to see acres and acres and acres of screeds of anti-Roman polemic. And we have some. The amount of evidence that we have from the Greek world increases exponentially over time. So by the time we get to the 2nd century BCE, and in particular, actually, into the period AD, we've got, you know, quite a lot of material. And as you would expect, there is a certain amount of anti-Roman feeling. But there is surprisingly little, actually, and that's quite hard to explain. I think the best way of explaining it is that, I mean, certainly our literary texts are written by the elite, and the elites are quite well looked after by the Romans. What Romans tended to do was to go into places and co-opt the local elites and get them to run the place rather than, especially as the empire expanded, you don't have enough resources native Romans everywhere. And the Romans also are quite generous with Roman citizenship. They bestow it quite liberally, and they're not like the Athenians, and who were very jealously protective of their identity. The Roman citizenship is quite easily dispersed. So what the Romans tend to do is they tend to go into places, take them over, as I say, not always by military means, co-opt the local elites, make them Roman citizens, and then these people who are Greek are also Roman as well. So they're sort of compromised and party free. My first book actually was about exactly this sort of thing, and it was about the 2nd century AD, and where it's the period from which we have most Greek literature, huge amounts of stuff there. And I was arguing really, it's a period of archaism where Greeks are going around obsessing with the past and pretending that they were 5th century Athenians and trying to speak in the same dialect of Greek as people in 5th century Athens and imitating a lot of literature and so forth. So my question was, why were people so obsessed with their roots, their sense of Greekness? And my answer was that actually it's all about Romanness. It's because these are Romans. It's because these are people whose identity is so compromised, and they're so sort of, you know, so they're kind of collaborateurs, if you like, you know, they're on the side of the Romans. And that's why they have to work so hard to prove their Greekness.
I love that question. Because you spoke about all of the other views, I was thinking, you haven't mentioned the Romans yet. And for me, looking at the relationship between the two, because again, I thought there would be so much more literature that would basically say, oh, those Romans, they're kind of barbaric a little bit. Us Greeks, we're much better. We're a higher class of people.
There is a bit of that. But as I say, the majority of what you might call, I'll qualify this in a sec, but what you might call mainstream Greek literature isn't like that from the Roman period. They you know, they tend to represent Romanness as a kind of badge of honour, and they tend to sort of parade relationships with rich Romans. They can look down on them in a rather snooty way as a sort of, you know, upstart, less civilised, less ancient people. But by and large, as I say, they're quite surprisingly pro Roman in a very sort of crude sense. But the exception is, and the reason why that narrative gets more complicated, is that, I mean, if, as I do, you take a very broad view of what is Greek, and you say that anything written in Greek, for example, is Greek, and you know, that might be denied by some ancient Greeks, but some other ancient Greeks would accept many different, would have a broader view of what counts as Greek. So where I'm pushing towards here is that, you know, if you include Jewish literature written in Greek, or if you include early Christian literature, then you get a very different perspective on these things. And I think you should include that stuff, because I think a lot of these people, you know, even if you're Jewish, you can call yourself Greek as well. I mean, people can concatenate identities in the ancient world. You don't have to be Jewish or Greek. You can be Jewish, Egyptian, Roman, and Greek simultaneously, and that's fine, you know. So as I say, if you look at it from that perspective, and you think about Christians and Jews, and of course we have quite a lot of their literature as well, then you can see a sort of pioneering sort of anti-Roman, anti-imperialist narrative emerging. But again, it's quite interestingly different from what you might expect in the modern world.
Talking about other people, staying on that topic, did they actually have a concept of, well, race?
Well, our concept of race is, you know, I mean, it has its roots really in the 19th century and in both the, you know, the sort of the politics of that era in terms of empire, the transatlantic slave trade, and also in racial pseudoscience, and, you know, the belief that different types of people were different orders of humanity, and sometimes, you know, some people thought that the human race wasn't even unified, that there were different species within the human sort of framework, whatever. So that concept of race emerges from a very specific historical context that is not replicated in the ancient world. They don't have, for example, an obsession with skin colour in classical antiquity. Of course, Greeks and Romans knew people with all sorts of different pigmentations, but they didn't think of these as sort of definitive in the way in which you carved up the human species. So, but on the other hand, they did have an idea of shared descent, which I mentioned earlier, which gives us the word, the Greek word is genos, which gives us the word genealogy, and genetics and that sort of thing, the gen bit of it. And a genos is sometimes translated as a race because it is often used of a people who are united by a sort of family relationship to each other. They're genealogically united, if you like. And that's a sort of a race-like concept. And of course, just as with modern races, you know, it is a fiction. A genos is, you know, you can never have a sort of a family model extended to include an entire community. There are too many, it's too complex and too weird and too fuzzy in practice. But that idea that a community might be an extension of a single family is an ancient Greek idea as well. And there is, this is partly why modern ideas of race have these sort of genetic or genealogical components, of course, because a lot of the architects of modern racism were reading classical material as well.
I think we should move over to something that's, for now, as in current day sort of politics. So why, well, first of all, we're going to start with statues. So why do people in our modern world get so upset about the, well, the colour of ancient statues?
This has blown up massively in the last 10 years or so. I mean, it's a really fascinating phenomenon. So just to put some context on here, we've known for a long time, in fact, since the 18th century, that some ancient statues were painted. And the early discussions around this were largely aesthetic. They were people got terribly worried about painted statues because there was a sort of a cult of, you know, the purity of marble and so forth. Winckelmann and, you know, all these sort of 18th century aesthetes are all on about, you know, how gaudy it would have been to have had painted statues. In more recent times, we have understood, because nowadays we can do scientific chemical tests on statues and we can discover traces of pigmentation, that sort of thing. So although this work is only really in its infancy, and we don't know about the extent of painting of statues and indeed temple architraves and so forth, you know, architectural features, which seem to have been painted as well. We don't know how much of it was actually painted in any sort of firm sense, but it's clear that a lot more was painted than it appears visible today, and it's very, very evidently clear. And what's behind a lot of the anxiety about this is, of course, racism. The idea of the Greeks as white has been so hardwired into a certain strain of European and European-descended thinking in the last 150 years that these statues have become iconic of Greek and European whiteness. We are a visual people, you know, we attach emotions and suggestions and associations to visual impressions. We all know what a Greek statue looks like, or at least we think we do, and that image is in very subtle ways ingrained in all of our minds. When you think of a Greek statue, you think of a white Greek statue, often against a blue sky, offsetting that whiteness. And that is not a neutral colour, white, and it hasn't been for the last, you know, how many, a few hundred years or whatever. Whiteness is actually a sort of an invisible mythology that we don't talk about enough. So when people have started pushing the idea that we should be thinking about statues by default as polychrome, as coloured, this upset an awful lot of people. And it upset an awful lot of people who were racist or are racist, but it also upset a lot of people who had sort of unexamined attachments to the myth of classical whiteness or whatever, which is a sort of more subtle or ingrained form of racism. They may not have thought of it as a racist belief, but it was sort of, you know, connected to a deep cultural racism.
I need to say that I was one of those people. I always thought that Greek statues were supposed to be white. So, you know, you go to the British Museum, they're all white. But then we took a trip one day at university and we went to the Ashmolean. And the Ashmolean, if I'm being correct on this, I think it's a statue of Augustus. And they've got a
King of Porter statue, yeah.
Yeah, so it's the statue of Augustus where it's completely white. And then they painted a copy, basically. And you can see all of these incredible bright colours. And it makes you completely think differently about what statues really look like. Because in reality, you're going to go to a temple or somewhere and statues are white. Well, why would they be? You know, you'd want more colour. You'd want more attractiveness, if that's the right way of saying it.
I think that's right. And I think we have to remember, as you say, where they're displayed. I mean, in the interior of buildings, and there's often not a lot of light, so you do need colour to pick them out. If you have a statue and you want it to be visible from a long way off, then yeah, colour is a really good way of marking that. I mean, I have to say that the jury is out on, I mean, for the reasons I've given, we just haven't done the chemical analysis of all statues, and many statues may not have residues of paint on them anyway, because they may have been cleaned or the paint may have just disappeared. So we don't actually know yet the extent of the painting of statues. But it is a very powerful, profound challenge to, as I say, some very deeply ingrained narratives.
So in your opinion, does the subject of classics need to be colonised?
Yeah. Classics has been, is very much a sort of 19th century, as I teach it now, and as, as most Anglophone universities teach it. I say I teach it, my university teaches it, and most Anglophone universities teach it, is very much a product of the 19th century, and it carries with it a lot of the sort of assumptions in that era. I mentioned earlier that, we tend to think of the classical world as stopping around 500, maybe actually a little bit earlier before that. Why is that? Well, it's all to do with Christianity. It's because of a sort of turf war between theology and classics. So in the 19th century, when classics and theology sort of split apart, the theologians got the Christian period and the classicists got the period up to that. Now, that's not a neutral way of thinking about things. That's a very obviously Christian influenced way of carving up time and therefore creating meaning out of antiquity. But you were asking about decolonization, and that really goes in, that's more of a kind of geographical issue at one level. It's about sort of, what kind of areas we value and what kind of cultures we value. I mean, I mentioned earlier that the Greeks are so heavily associated with myths of European pure ancestry. The idea that we culturally or genetically, that's a big we in inverted commas, culturally or genetically descend from the Greeks is so thoroughly enshrined in people that has sort of lent a kind of value to the classical. You might be worth pausing to think a little bit about what the classical actually means. It comes from a Roman economic term marking the highest level of tax band in society. They're the people that contribute, the classici are the people that contribute to the classis, to the upkeep of the fleet. Okay, so it's got elitism, it's got selection built into the concept right from the very start, right from the get-go. And the lionization of imperial cultures, classical Athens, Augustan Rome, or whatever, is all tied up with empire. If you look at school books from the 19th century and from the 20th century, a lot of the texts that are chosen are for translation for kids, supposedly to teach them constructions and that sort of thing. A lot of the passages are about conquering foreign peoples and enslaving them and so forth. There's a lot of tacit learning about how to be an imperial power that comes through the classical world. I would say, though, I wouldn't be doing this subject if I didn't think that there was something more to it than that. And I think there is something more to it than that. I think that it's always been a sort of the imperial sort of colonial aspect of classics doesn't define or restrict everything that is done within the field. And if you think about something like, the late 19th century, when people were beginning to dig stuff up, and archaeology became a key constituent part of the classical discipline in universities, then people's views of the ancient world would change radically, and they were driven by material evidence, and the evidence came up and people had to take account of it, and they realized that these people that they thought of as sort of very high-minded people, very intellectual people, actually who had all sorts of other preoccupations. And there was all sorts of other weirdnesses at the level of, religion and daily life and practice and so forth that really disrupted people's sense of what the Greeks were like. Anthropology also in the late 19th and throughout the 20th century had a huge impact on classics. People borrowed methodologies from anthropologies which were developed perhaps also with an equally imperial aspect to them as well, but were developed to help understand non-Greek peoples, and they used them to help understand the Greeks. And increasingly, I think the Greeks were seen throughout the 20th century through this anthropological lens, not as ancestors of a putative European people, but as a strange, bizarre people who needed to be understood in all of their bizarreness and oddity and otherness. So there are all these cross currents within the classical world. It isn't straightforwardly a colonial imperial discipline. It is a big capacious discipline. But you're asking, does the subject have to decolonize? I say yes, it does. I think we are still teaching a very restricted view of the ancient world, which is built around elitism, built around class values, built around power and authority, and not exposing enough, I think, the variety of peoples in the ancient world. I mean, I mentioned earlier, but my hobby horse of mine about sort of including Jews and Christians within our narrative of the classical world. We teach Greek and Latin, but we don't teach in classics departments. We don't teach Egyptian or Akkadian. We have huge amounts of material in both of those languages. The neighboring peoples, they had a lot to do with Greeks and Romans. Some very pioneering scholars have done a lot of work on, you know, trying to bring these together, but it's very hard to do when your disciplinary structures are restricting the study of the Mediterranean, pouring resource into the study of the Greeks and the Romans as if they were in isolation from or superior to all the other peoples around at the time. So I would push very strongly, if I had a blueprint for classics in the 21st century, I would push for understanding other languages, understanding other cultures in antiquity, a more sophisticated understanding of methodologies, a more sophisticated understanding of the diversity of identities and different peoples in antiquity. And I would put this at the forefront of the curriculum, not make it something that people, you know, can do in their PhDs if they really want to do.
That was absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us today to be able to talk about Greek identity, how the Greeks viewed other people, how the Greeks viewed the Romans, how they viewed themselves, the superiority, obviously, of the Athenians, as always, and probably my favourite point about the ancient statues. So thank you so much. And we'll definitely get you back on to talk about some Greek literature. So thank you so much.
Yeah, really good to meet you.
Join us tomorrow when Gabby Story will be here. She is brilliant. She came on and we talked medieval badass queens. We've compared and contrasted Queen Matilda and Eleanor of Aquitaine, who received many, many votes in our Greatest Britain poll. So join us to find out how they were similar, how they differed, and about some of the just insanity that they had to deal with.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.